like seeing you all that well. The song written by Orville Redenbacher. I'm the guy who didn't marry pretty Pamela Brown, educated, well intentioned, with a girl in our town. Wonder where I'd be today if she had loved me too. Probably be driving kids to school. I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. All of my good times, all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town, and I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. Seen the lights of cities, and I've been inside the door. Sailed to foreign countries and walked upon their shore. I guess the guy she married was the best part of my luck. She dug him cause he drove a pickup truck. I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. All of my good times, all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town. Yes, I owe it all to Pamela to tell you just how beautiful she was. Everything it takes to get a guy like me in love. Lord, I hope she's happy because she sure deserves to be, especially for what she did for me. And I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. All of my good times, all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town, and I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. Guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to see you all here. Thank you for coming. I'm reminded of something that Ronnie Scott said one night when he was going on stage at a club in London. This was some time ago. He walked on stage. The club, by the way, was called Ronnie Scott's. He walked on stage and he said, I should have stayed in bed. There were more people there. Good to see you. Change a thing really, but now it's in tune. I climbed the hill to Julie's house, the place I used to live. I climbed the steps and tried the door and let myself in. I used to watch it, stopped at 5 to 5. A photograph I'd never seen. A car came up the drive. I stood outside the kitchen door. She turned her head. I said that I was back to stay. She laughed at what I said. She said that I'd grow old, believing I was what mattered most. I'd uncover real feelings when I got close. I climbed the hill to Julie's house, the place I used to live. I climbed the steps and tried the door and let myself. Thank you. attempted college careers in my life. The first one ended when I quit because it was too hard. And I had already joined the Navy when I was 17, and immediately realized the next day that I'd better go to college. But it was too hard, and I quit, and now I've had to go on active duty. And I hitchhiked from Columbia, Missouri, out to the east coast of North Carolina, and then up to New London, where I went into the Navy. And the most remarkable thing about that trip were the interesting people you would meet. Far too interesting. And every now and then, with someone who just made everything a lot easier. And I was somewhere in West Virginia, and I was that had been dropped at a place where there was no hope of getting a ride. And it was I couldn't even tell you where this was or what it was, except it didn't look good. You know, a Meridian, there's two lanes going that way, two lanes going this way. Meridian was pretty wide, it was getting dark. Very difficult to hitchhike in the dark. And I was broke, but there was a little, I'm always wondering how that word is pronounced, C-O-P-S-E, the copse of, not trees in this case, it would be wrong to call it a copse, a copse, or whatever, a copse. There's a little bundle of sort of like shrubs, and in the middle of the meridian, I figured I could sleep there, but I would blend in well enough. I had a large plaid suitcase. Go undetected in the greenery. This is the way you think. And a guitar. And I was heading down toward the shrubs thinking things had gotten a little tight, and a family drove by going, you know, I'm going that way. They drove by headed that way. A man and a wife, I'm assuming, and some smaller heads in the car. I headed toward the tree, there was a honk, and it was that family, and the guy stuck his head out the window and said, what are you doing? That's an essay question, and I didn't have to, or I didn't want to get into it. And I said, well, probably. I mean, I don't remember. I felt a little bit threatened because I learned to expect that, especially at twilight. And he said, are you looking for a ride? And I said, well, I can't get any here. He said, we'll take you where you can. And he stuck me in the car. I got in the back seat. The three kids immediately appeared in the front seat looking back at me like a crustacean of some kind in their aquarium. And they drove me the opposite direction of wherever they were going for about 20 minutes, I suppose, out to a truck stop. Open all night, lights. I wasn't going to get any sleep, but I was going to get a lift. All of that has nothing to do with this next tune, except that it fits the title that came up before I ever remembered it. It's called Four Cents. Thank you. There's a book out called The Rest is Noise, written by Alex Ross, who's a music critic for the New Yorker. I think that's it. That's really killing me. I run out of... what happens is I get more dots than I can keep track of. I gotta look at these damn things. I'm supposed to be able to close my eyes and play and talk at the same time as somebody requesting Taco Bell's Cannon in the loud. I can't do any of that. I greatly admire that skill. Orchestral composition in the 20th century. You should run out and get it, actually. Dynamite. He confirmed something that I had always suspected, which is that there was a real concerted effort to erase forever the major third from the Western idea of music. It's been my job in life to defend the major third. In several interviews with Bob Dylan, he's mentioned that all he had to listen to on the radio in hippie growing up was "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?" I thought that was a fairly cool tune at the time. In Cheyenne. And granted, there, you know, major thirds are the lair of, it's the other way around. Forget that. Bubblegum is built on major thirds, and it's one of the reasons more responsible composers want to get rid of it. Is the guilt by association is congealed around the major third. I think I've mentioned here before that in the 70s, I met the guy who wrote "Yummy, Yummy, Yummy, I've Got Love in My Tummy." But I didn't hurt him, but I met him. And I have to say this, I get into this all the time. Anytime I start winding on about major thirds, is that I got that tune, you know, the good thing about bubblegum is they do know about hooks, and when the hooks are good, they're the best, but when they're bad, and they stay with you when they're good, and you're happy about that. When they're bad, you resent it, and it's difficult to dump this stuff. You know how you get it. And I would play the show with David Lindley in Bozeman, and the next morning I came into that, you know, that breakfast pit that they have at the motel. Dave was sitting over there, and I knew that if anybody knew how to do this, it was Dave. And went up to him and I said, "I've got this tune stuck in my head and I can't get it out." And he said, "What is it?" That's a very trenchant sort of question, I think. And I said, "Well, yummy, 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 I've got a lot of it." And he said, "Oh, yeah." If there's any water floating around back there somewhere, that'd be great. And, said, "You can get rid of it. What you have to do is you have to sing it backwards. It'll be in some of your heads now. So this is how you get rid of it. Sing it backwards in your head, and it'll be 180 degrees out with itself, out of phase, and it'll cancel." It worked. It worked immediately. It never come back to bother me. And I did it with one other tune. I can't remember what the tune was. This thing, if anything is bubblegum, this tune is bubblegum. But it's one of those tunes that it's been a hit 3 times. Nobody minds it. It was written for a wedding by Eddie Reeves and Alex Harvey. Thank you. Here's another one. This is the this is not bubblegum. A lot of major thirds. There are a lot of orchestral instrumentals, band like big band instrumentals, and later on some sort of small ensemble instruments. That sound is, they were big hits. You don't hear that kind of thing much anymore. The Blue Tango, Trumpeter's Holiday, to name a couple, Twilight Time by the Three Sons. But they all sound as if they were written on a guitar. They aren't recorded on a guitar. Thank you. stare at one of these for a little too long. Not going anywhere. This is not my own microphone, but so, 3 years ago I started carrying my own vocal mic because, you know, the microphones you get at a hall have, usually it's a Shure 58, and which was invented somewhere in World War II to replace the PA on the, you know, the battle announcements on the ships. Nobody could understand, you know, it's kind of critical to understand what you were being told to do. So they came up with this idea, and it became eventually the bulwark of show business, at least for vocalists. So some of these mics that I would sing on have been around in a club, let's say, for 30 years or 40 years. They've been there for, and imagine, I mean, well, you can imagine, I don't have to paint a picture. I mean, I was somewhere one night, and this is, you know, and I was right up here, because this 58 likes you to be right up here. This mic likes you to be back here somewhere. And I was up here singing, and I pulled back to get some air, just to get away from that damn thing for a minute. And the mic came with me. And the hair had insinuated. Sure. You know. And you're singing. You'd really like to stop and think about this. You know, whose hair was that? What hair? Hair? And, you know, they sneeze on them, etc. People are, you know, Johnny Rotten would probably beat himself in the face with this thing. How his career got started, probably. Johnny Rotten? No, wrong guy. Oh, never mind. But that was the night I decided to carry my own microphone. They have mic vaults in some place, this big, and it is a vault, it's an anvil case. It looks like something for carrying fuel rods for a nuclear reactor. There's little holes in it, and they're filled with these 58s. And they just sit in there festering until so a star comes along. Infests himself. So I'm comfortable with this mic. I know where it's been. Let me explain. He's twice it just left. So I won't know that. Set list, by the way. It really shows. If there's this one character up there and they're playing from the set list, that's grim. It's like reality guitar. I'll do that. I learned something really critically important when I tried to figure this tune out. This was written by Pete Seeger, and it was recorded. It's been recorded several times by him. The vocal, which I suggest you avoid, and a great duet with Frank Hamilton, and my favorite when he would. At one point, he would whistle along with this tune. You won't hear that tonight. I used to have really prehensile lips. To see me pucker was a matter of some concern. I could evert my lips without using my hands. I could just turn them inside out. You know, you can imagine why I thought that was worth showing anyone. I mean, it started when I was living in Cheyenne and listening to How Much Is That Doggy in the Window. And I wanted to be able to do this, and I couldn't do it. So I tied a string around each pair of fingers so that I couldn't help it do it. And I'd ride around on my bicycle doing this. This is before I found the guitar. It saved me from a lot of it. So I thought, well, if I could do that, maybe I could do that. So I tied one off, three off, different variations, and I really got into it. Spent a lot of time on my bicycle. And then somewhere along the line, I started wondering what else I could do as I seize control of my body. And I cannot do this anymore. I don't know what happened, but I decided that it would be sterling, you know, if I could move my eyes independently of one another. My first idea was to do that, you know. But don't even try, you know, it's not going to happen. But you can. I mean, first, you know, you start here, of course. Everybody can do that. By the way, I knew a guy who worked with Gene Pitney as his tour manager, and who had a brother who was told, don't cross your eyes. Someday you won't be able to uncross them. He was crossing them at an escalator somewhere, fell down the escalator with his eyes crossed, and they, according to Gene Pitney, they stuck that way. Gene Pitney would send in Australia. He was a big hit in Australia as he was in a lot of places. And he would send his orchestra guy down there who would rehearse the orchestra. Contract the orchestra, go through the charts, and get everything ready. So all Gene had to do was do a run through the day before the first show, and they're off and running. He got down there one year for the tour, and he said to his own conductor, and he said, "Well, how's it going? Is everything working all right?" He said, "It's great. It's a good orchestra." I'm quoting him. I never heard a word he said, but I mean, I have to give you something. But he told Gene that there was one problem, but it wasn't really a problem. He said it'll look like a problem, but when you hear the guy, you'll be completely at ease. He's a great player. Well, what's the problem? He's the bass player. He only has one hand.
It's true, but this guy was a famous player in Australia. And Gene said, well, how does he, you know? And he said, well, he's got a kind of a thing here, and there's a pick in it. And he plays great, it just works great. Okay, and of course, they're playing somewhere. Early on in the tour, there's a clunk, the band comes to a halt. Gene says, what's wrong? He said, got his hand fell off. I'm free associating now. I'm going to tell you about the time I took the MMPI. So I got to here and I can't do this anymore, but I could move one, without moving this eyeball, I could move that one back and forth. And then I could roll around and I can't do it. It hurts. It would move independently. He said, move it. Excuse me. I got that. And then the last thing was my lips. I thought, ooh, I could. That took no work at all. I'd like to know what everting my lips has to do with Pete Seeger and his tune, but it escapes me. Sorry. I started talking when I'm playing because I didn't look up for 3 years after I started playing in a coffee house in Minneapolis, actually. My first performance was in D.C. I did other things, but mainly, and I couldn't look up, couldn't talk. One night I remembered something, I couldn't resist saying it out loud, and now I'm looking at them. I'm talking and I have to keep talking and it worked out. And the thing is, at the end of it, I knew what to play. I don't know, without a set list, I don't know what to play. Unless at some point I've got to start talking. Probably, and then I'll know. It doesn't matter what I say. Unfortunately, it should matter more than it does. Not much I can do about that. And I had it, now I've forgotten it again. Anyhow, in this tune, there is something that we would call a push. Excuse me. I didn't know about a push. It's right here, right there, the book on it. Right there. Only he does that, but he also does it. Do-da-da, he puts a push in there. I can't do it. I do something else. Anyhow, this is... harder than learning how to evert my lips or move my eyeballs. Thank you. requests for many years, and I always ignored the request because I hated the tune. And it occurred to me after a while that that's probably not a good idea to not play the stuff somebody wants to hear that has bought a ticket. I mean, even I could tell that was kind of contrary to show business. So I went back and I looked at, part of it was that this was, I wrote this in, the, I don't know, 64 or 65, and that's a completely different hit than what I have now. And it's not entirely a pleasant experience to get back into that hit. It depends on the tune. And this tune, it didn't fit. So I looked at it, and as happened with another tune that I might get to here, I realized it was just an editing problem. I edited it, it still sucked. And it boiled down to a section that it was just bad, and I thought, well, I can do something better than that. I don't have to live with this. And everything I did failed. It was better, and then I realized it's because I'm writing with this head. I can't go back and get the head, and whatever I do, it's going to be an anachronism, and I'm screwed. And I got very angry with the people who requested it over the years. And then I had my bright idea, and realized that if I go back to the 60s and steal something from there, it ought to work. So I'd like to thank Tommy James and Shondell Smith for this tune. This is one of those songs that everybody tries to do, and some few people really get it right, and So if you have the itch to do it yourself, you're going to have to find a way to be comfortable, as opposed to just something that you can live with. You know, to get it off your mind, it'll haunt you sort of like if you don't do it. I finally found a way through it, changed it, added a lyric. And it's a very simple tune, and it's something just right about it. The first time I heard this done, it was being sung by John Hurt in a little coffee house in Washington, D.C. And his wife was there with him, and John at that point was the oldest human being I'd ever seen. I think I was 16 at the time. And his wife was in a very small place, about as big as the stage, and about as big as my foot. And she was sitting right in front of his foot. And he had a smile that was beyond radiant. Had no teeth in it. He had two teeth left, I think, at that time. It was just devastating. And if you didn't know it, you could see it. Because he'd send one of these rays to his wife down there. But it looked even older than he did, as far as I could tell. And she'd try to, you know, erect something to send back to us. She couldn't do it. She just, you know, like a bobblehead. And he knew it. You know, he'd zap her with it, especially during this tune. And I saw that from over there somewhere, and I thought, oh, I want some of that. And then I thought, oh, no, I don't want it. But I was, you know, of course I was right.
Talks to me.
pina colada. Where you been for so long? And I've been worried about you ever since you've been gone. Thank you. Consonant what the Hawaiians have done for the vowel. My grandparents on my dad's side immigrated here from a place near Posen, and they wouldn't speak their language in front of anybody, but I was very small at the time. I was pretty sure that I could hide behind a conch shell that they had. Where they got that thing, I have no idea. And I knew that, and I was mystified and hypnotized by the language. And I knew that if I smelled Hans beer and summer sausage, that the language would be forthcoming. So when I would smell this, I'd, you know, run behind the conch shell, wherever I thought I was invisible. I imagine I wasn't too much of a threat for them. And this mysterious stuff is happening. Thank you. make a living in their furnace. This is a coal-fired furnace. I was seven? This is, you know, nah. And I could tell, you know, he's going to entertain me. You know so much when you're 7 years old. And he said, well, I'll show you. I'll go down and I'll aggravate the snake. You stand up here and by the heating grate and listen. So he went down to irritate the snake that lived in his furnace, which, you know, unfortunately this was the summertime, and I heard the door open down there, and I didn't want to be participating in this, but he opened the door, clank, and then the next thing he heard was, woo! Just like a snake. Snakes all speak the same language. Nothing but sibilance for them. Anyhow, this is called Gewerbegebiet. It's the most beautiful word in the German language. I have heard it translated as industrial park, but it actually means more like business center. And every time I have said the word to anybody who is, you know, any German, this happens exactly three times. I'll say Gewerbegebiet, they'll say, what? I'll say Gewerbegebiet, what? Two times. And then the third time I said Gewerbegebiet, they say, oh, Gewerbegebiet. I swear, there's no difference. I mean, I can hear somebody say Kati, Koka, Hafa, Koke, Koke. I mean, I know what they're saying. I'm bitter. Maybe I'll close with this, and it's a nice thing to end with, because again, this is something else I talk about all the time, because this knocks me out. I haven't sorted it through yet. I probably never will. But one of my first tours in Germany, an old couple came back. It was in the 70s, and they said, our name is Kotke. I said, I've got to be going. I was headed right out the door. And they said, no, we're not related. Well, that was good. And they said, we have something that you should see. And they gave me a playbill. Handed me a playbill from something like 1911, I've forgotten the year. And they said, this is for a concert given by a young woman named, I think her first name was Ernestine Kotke. And she was the star in Germany around the turn of the century, playing Bach and Liszt on her piano. And this is from a concert in Berlin, and it was the last concert she ever gave. She died shortly after this. She was 23 years old. So I looked at the playbill, and their photograph is on the cover. She had a lot of hair piled up, and something like a bustle, or I don't know what was going on there, but I looked that up on, you know. And she's got that pose, standing in the dimple at the piano, you know, the curve of the piano like this. And I looked, and it was me in the bustle with a big pile of hair. I'm telling you, it wasn't an uncanny resemblance. It was me. I looked at him, and the guy tapped on her head in the photo and said, we think you're related. I've thought about it ever since. They wouldn't let me have the playbill. They took it away. This was, you know, the OSS had all died out. There was no Photoshop or anything like that. This was, it was me. I decided that I must have just tired of the piano. I want something more portable. And I was willing to give up my life and my gender to do it. So again, if you hadn't been here tonight, after all of that, it would have been awful. So thank you again for coming. Thank you. Secondary market. And they said, well, the reason the secondary market is a secondary market is because nobody can get there, and nobody's going to want to promote you in those places. One guy turned up, and because of Bill, I've gotten to play places like Sand Point, Idaho, Pocatello, Hutchinson, Minnesota. People there. You can play there. They have some nice halls. But after a little bit of that, we started playing places like this. We've never left Sandpoint. This is Bill's last night as a promoter. I'm going to miss a lot of the secondary.